The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming today to the day one of the two-day workshop, Legal Skills for International Public Interest. My name is Melania Radnovich. I'm an assistant director for International Career Programs at the Office of Career and Professional Development. As we know, nowadays there are endless possibilities for attorneys to engage in international public interest career field. By doing work in diplomacy, policy making, administration, internationally oriented advocacy and activism, you could be working on strengthening the rule of law, documenting human rights abuses, humanitarian work, or expanding capacity in developing countries, leading projects focused on improving the environmental protection or sustainability, or the economic growth of the areas in desperate need. You might be working for non-government organization, international organizations, or government. In order to have a successful career in any of a diverse range of career opportunities in the field of international public interest, regardless of the employment sector you will be engaging with, surely in addition to have a law degree, great legal professional skills, knowledge and expertise in particular area of law, you nowadays definitely have to have additional skills and capabilities. And this is exactly what the focus of the two-day workshop will be. So we will be talking about fundraising, program management, budget management, grant administration, monitoring, evaluation, advocacy, government practice. And we are able to offer this great opportunity thanks to our speakers, Christy Edwards and Eric Gutrier, who will be joining us tomorrow, who took their time from their busy schedules, actually, to be with us. Eric Gutrier tomorrow and Christy Edwards for 2 days. She will be with us today and tomorrow. I would like to take the time to read Christy's bios. You do have a handout, but we have a number of people, our alumni and students community, who was not able to participate with us, so we are actually recording this presentation. Christy Edwards has worked on international human rights, international humanitarian law, international development policy, and gender issues for several VC organizations, including Vital Voices Global Partnership, Women Thrive Worldwide, and the Institute for Women's Policy Research. As the director of the International Humanitarian Law Team at the American Red Cross, Christy leads the organization's public outreach efforts on international humanitarian law. She received her JD from Thomas Jefferson School of Law, specializing in international human rights law, in addition to her private practice of asylum representation for political refugees. She became an adjunct professor and pro bono fellow in 2007 at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, teaching an international human rights course and coaching students to compete in an international moot court competition. Christy also completed her LLM at American University Washington College of Law International Legal Studies program, specializing in international human rights and gender. In 2010, she received a Helton Fellowship from the American Society of International Law, which allowed her to work in Casablanca, Morocco, with local NGOs on advocacy campaign to greater legal rights for single mothers. She has published law review articles on cultural context of sex trafficking in China, the use of gender budget analysis to achieve educational parity for women and girls, and legal advocacy strategies for women's rights in Morocco. As the co-chair of the ASIL, American Society of International Law Women and International Law Interest Group, Christy also leads the Women in International Law Mentoring Program and organizes public events on women and international law. I would like you to join me in welcoming Christy Edwards.
Thanks so much, Melania. It's wonderful to be here, and I really appreciate all of your support. And so I have a more, I guess, casual presentation style, and since there are a smaller group of us, I'm wondering if we can first quickly rearrange the chairs. Let's do a semicircle so it can be more of a conversation. And while we're doing that, if those of you who joined us last minute wouldn't mind grabbing one of each of the handouts in the back, we're going to basically just go through them all during the presentation today. Actually, Chelsea, if you wouldn't mind grabbing me one of each as well,
that would be helpful.
Waiting for Cliff to grab the last handout for those of you who are listening online, and we'll start in just a second. So I just wanted to, start by saying I want to be clear about what this workshop is and what it is not. As a little bit of background, I knew I wanted to go into nonprofit work before I went to law school, and so I specifically chose schools and internships and job opportunities that would give me the kind of experience that I knew I needed in order to work in a nonprofit setting. But the law field has definitely changed a lot since I graduated, and a lot of people now that might not have thought that they were going to work in public interest or for an NGO often find themselves looking for those kinds of opportunities when they are graduating or when they're looking for a job opportunity. But there is a rather specific skill set that comes along with working in nonprofit that you do need to have in order to be competitive for those jobs. And it's not impossible to get them, but you do need to think very strategically about what those are, be familiar with those terms, look for opportunities, specifically in internships or other job opportunities that you might be able to get while you're in school in order to be able to get those kinds of jobs once you graduate. So today I'm just going to basically go over kind of a high level, show you some examples of what some of the basic skill sets and tools are. I'm not going to go into great depth and teach you how to use all of these tools because we could be here for a week. And there are really great trainings out there that will go into great detail and teach you how to use these tools. But I at least want you to be familiar with what the terms are and know where to go for more information. And we have a list of resources that I'm going to bring in tomorrow that have a list of places where you can go for additional training. Some of them are for free. And you can look for other ways to get some of those skills either through those trainings or at least to know when you're looking for internship opportunities to ask whether or not you're going to get some of these. So the basics of any, I think the most fundamental thing that comes into play when looking at any NGO community in particular is that the bottom line or the funding for that work is going to be the most important issue that every NGO faces. If you don't have donors or supporters for your work, you can't operate. And that's a very hard thing to do because especially a lot of donors want to contribute to projects and not necessarily overhead, but if you don't have money to keep the lights on and pay your staff, you can't do your projects. And so there's a little bit of a give and take with donors, helping them to understand that the overhead and the staff costs are actually very important. We're first going to talk a little bit about fundraising and program development because this is to the foundation of what you're going to need to do. So the first handout that you should have available is a sample letter of inquiry. It's the Chelsea, is it this one? Yes, the one that says Sonia Open at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can take a look at but it's a very simple document. And this is often sort of the first step when looking at funding resources. Please come join us. I hope you guys, did you guys get one of the handouts in the back? Okay. Feel free to come up and we're doing more of a semicircle as opposed to, there's a couple seats up here in the front. So let's say you've got a donor ladies, there's handouts in the back, so please grab one of each of them and then come join us. There's lots of seats up here in the front. So let's say you've done some research, you have a potential donor that has areas of interest that, let's say it's a foundation, and they are really, really interested in funding youth projects, particularly underserved communities focusing on diverse youth. And you think, okay, great, I've got this NGO, or I work for this NGO that can totally do that. I've got some great ideas for how to reach out to those kinds of underserved communities, and you've got some really great ideas of how you want to work, but you need the money to do it. So often the first step is writing a letter of inquiry. You send them a letter saying, you know, you've read their website, you've read maybe their request for proposals, you know what it is that they're interested in doing, and then you talk about the need, the number of underserved youth in your community, maybe how the lack of job opportunities or the lack of places for kids to go for childcare has had X number of negative effects on the community that you live in, and you've got some great ideas for how to engage youth and channel some of their free time and abilities into really positive directions. So you're going to outline what that need is, and it, for especially for law students, this is kind of a really basic form of an IROC analysis that all of you are familiar with. You've got your issue, you've got your rule, or what it is that they want to fund. We're going to talk about your analysis. Again, this is really, really basic. Why that this the program that you've got in mind applies to the kinds of funding opportunity that they have available, and then how you're going to do it, your conclusion. So again, take a look more at the letter, and you're also going to give a bit of an explanation of who you are or your organization, who it is that's going to be implementing this program, because you've obviously got some expertise in this field or in this type of endeavor, and so you want to sell yourself as well as selling the program, because you are obviously incredibly capable of implementing this program successfully. Or you have a strategy of how to address, if you're working on a gender-based violence campaign in the Congo, it's a really, really complex area. There's a lot of risk factors to take into consideration. And so you might want to address how you thought about those and what mitigating ideas or factors that you might want to include to say, well, if this doesn't work or if there are challenges in this way, I've got these ideas of how to address them. But again, a letter of inquiry is going to be really, really high level. So it's not going to go into incredible, incredible depth. It's more of a kind of whet their appetite, get them interested or excited about your project. Maybe you may or may not, depending on what their sort of guidelines are, if they have any, give them a number. Sometimes donors like that, sometimes they don't, but you can kind of talk to them about it. And how much you think it's going to cost. So if you think, I can do this amazing project for $500,000, they like round numbers. If you tell them $463,067, they, at this point, might not be that specific, but if you say, for $500,000, we could do this really amazing project. Once you start negotiating and there's really some interest there, then you could say, okay, well, it's actually going to be $463,067, whatever. So any questions on this so far? Yes, Jessica.
I was just wondering about when the language that you use, do you use this as if you've already got your project in place, so it's showing them like my project. Like this, in this example, it's like a future project, but she starts it by like explaining it as if it exists right now. And do you think that's more useful or less useful? Is there like a particular style that's normally used in letters of inquiry?
Really depends. If you've already got an established program, then you want to use that example of your established program For those of you who are listening, the question was, is it best to talk about established programs or new programs? And the answer is, if you have an established program and you've seen some successes or you've seen how this is working, talk about that, because it's probably a great thing that you've already got going. Maybe you've learned some things along the way. You've tweaked it in order to better address the needs of that community or implement the project maybe more resourcefully, or find additional partners in the community that are working on something similar that you can leverage those resources. So you would want to mention that. If it's something brand new, and you can say, look, there's a massive need in this community, nobody is addressing it, or I've got this brilliant idea of how to address it better than anybody else has ever thought of, put that in there. Because that's obviously something to sell, quote unquote, as well. Any other questions?
When you send this kind of letter, did you already have like any kind of personal approach before to send the letter, or how you do it? Because sometimes you send in the letter, they just put it on the table and they forget about it. So how you do this first approach? How you go and knock the door and say, hey, I'm from this organization and I need money for it?
Many letters of inquiry are sort of cold calls. And that's why they're short, because they're not going to read, you know, if they don't know who you are, if they've never heard of you, they're not going to read a 10 or 40 page full proposal. This is often a great way to try to get your foot in the door. If you have a personal connection, that's much better. You know, if you've met somebody at a networking event, or you've got a personal connection, if your friend happens to know somebody and they could introduce you and you could get a personal conversation either in person or over the phone, much better, because people can often sell themselves a lot better in person than they can on paper. So if you have the ability to get a personal conversation, highly, highly, highly recommend it. And sometimes that's also a way to get your letter of inquiry in front of them to show a little bit more depth in some of the conversations that you've already had. You know, you might not have time in a one-on-one conversation. It might be a 3-minute conversation at a networking event, and you heard that this person or this donor often gives grants for underserved youth communities. And you say, oh my gosh, that's really fantastic. I've got an organization that works on these types of issues. Could I get your card? I'd love to talk further about, you know, what kinds of work you support. And then you can follow up either in an email or in person, and, you know, bring with you the letter of inquiry or send it and just say, this is the kind of work that we're doing. We'd really love to explore opportunities to work together. And that's a little bit sort of less scary than just sending it to, you know, the Carnegie Foundation and really hoping that they're going to read through thousands of letters of inquiry and pick yours. Sometimes it works. I'm not saying that it doesn't. It's just, if you have the ability to have a personal connection, it's always best. And that's where networking really, really comes in handy. I hope that answers your question. Any other questions? Okay, great. So the next example that I wanted to show you guys was a sample proposal. And by the way, these are all on the Foundation Center website. These are free. You can download them. Check them out, because I did not make them up. But they're just good examples of what a proposal looks like. So you'll see in the cover letter for this, this guy has had a personal conversation with the donor. He knows what their goals are, he's talked to them about what they're interested in, and he's now making a more formalized pitch for funding for a particular project. And so this similar format to the letter of inquiry, but gives much more detail. So, you know, they're pretty upfront about how much money they're requesting, what they plan to do with it, why this is a big need, some of their past work is shown to be very successful. They talk about expanding on what works, so showing, you know, how they've been successful in the past and scaling up, showing that they're not necessarily reinventing the wheel, but trying to be successful in ways that they've shown proven success in the past, and applying that to maybe new communities or new ideas in order to expand that. Towards the bottom, laying out how this would work, what the
they have a system of small grants. So explain how that process would run, how much money it would be, who would be involved in the process, how they would manage that those funds, and how this relates to the core mission and goal of the foundation that they're applying for money from. And then there's a sample budget, program budget, so showing exactly where all of the money would go for, how it would be spent. You know, there's the direct expenses, which are the program expenses, but then also, again, staffing and overhead. I know donors don't like it necessarily, but or don't always like it, but it's absolutely vital because you guys aren't probably going to be doing this work for free. Somebody has to pay you in order to do it because you are brilliant and you have fabulous legal and technical skills that you deserve to be paid for. So again, pretty standard. This is a high-level budget. It's not in great detail because it is a program or a proposal budget, so it's going to be probably a bit more broad. And you don't want to go into, you know, literally every pencil and flight that you might be looking in a proposal, because they don't necessarily care at this stage where every single dollar of that $400,000 or $2 million is going to go. But this is more of a simple proposal to a foundation. If you're applying for a state or USAID proposal, sometimes these things can be 40 pages long. They require quite a bit more information included. Some of the things that they do require, we're going to go over in a minute, but they also give very, 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 very strict and clear descriptions of exactly what they want in that proposal. So it's not like you're guessing what goes into that 40 pages. They will literally tell you how many pages, what size font, what size margins, in order to include in that packet of information. So if you are applying for USG money, it's a bit more of a process, but again, not impossible. And because you're all lawyers and have the skills to make excellent legal arguments, I have full confidence that you guys will be able to figure it out. It looks a bit daunting when you're looking at something that big, but it's not overly complicated. Any questions with the proposal? Yeah. Sorry, let's just use the mic for the folks.
I'm just going to run that around and make sure.
Would you ever put things like photographs and pictures if they are previous projects that you've done or similar things, just to kind of emphasize what you're doing?
I've done it in letters of inquiry, sometimes including, because it's like a one- to two-page document, I mean, front and back. If there's a place where you can include a little quote blurb or a picture from one of a past successful program, it makes it more visually appealing. The example that that I included here, it's just a letter. It's very plain. But some of the ones that I've used, they're in full color, and they do include photographs. You know, if there's great numbers to call out, you know, we know that this program can reach 48,000 people through this mechanism, you know, include that. They like to see sort of high-level bullet point information saying, okay, if you're going to spend $500,000, you're going to reach X number of people, they're going to be doing this many things per year. So make it as visually appealing as possible, because again, they're not going to spend a lot of time reading it. It's kind of like a resume. You know, you spend maybe a minute reading, but they're not going to have a lot of time to read it over. So the prettier you can make it, of course, make sure that the content is spot on. It's going to be more of an attention hour. Anybody else have any questions? Okay. So then moving on to the proposal budget. The one I included, okay, it's the one that looks like this. It's a budget proposal on the top. So this is one that I've actually developed for a proposal that I won. And it's, again, somewhat high level. This version and also a summary budget, so just the line items. Sorry, it's a bit hard to read, but so there was another version that went along with this, another tab that just showed total salaries and fringe benefits, total travel, total contractual and total other direct costs, and then the final total budget. So it was like six lines altogether. It was not the detail. In a minute, we're going to talk. I'll show you guys a program budget, which goes into great detail. And I see some of you have already started looking at the actual detail budget. But this is basically how you're going to put together, high level, to some extent, how you're going to spend that money. And you'll see in the cost share item, that was from a pot of money from a different program, from a different donor, that we said we were going to be able to use. So the cost of that would be applied to the total program, but we're not charging the donor for that. So it just says, okay, this program is actually worth $513,000, but you only have to pay $500,000 of it. And some donors, specifically the U.S. government, often require you to have 20% of your total budget, or some other number, as cost share. So you have to actively seek other pots of money to contribute to that total amount. So if you have any opportunities to include cost share, donors really like it because they like to see that they're getting the most bang for their buck. And it makes it look like you've really got your act together. All right, any questions on what's in? Well, actually, let's go through it in a little bit more detail. So the salaries, you would include everybody that's going to be working on that project. Here I listed some sample roles. You'll see in the percentage of unit, that's how much time they're going to spend on that particular project. You might have your VP working on five different projects, so they're only going to spend 15% of their total time on this project. The director and program manager is spending a little bit more time. It might only be one person working on a project. It might only be like a program manager or program officer that's going to work on a particular grant or award. And so whatever percentage of time, whether it's 100% or 15, I did not include salary numbers in here because that will, of course, depend on every person. But the total for salaries, just salaries, was about $88,000 as a sample. And then the fringe, it's whatever. So how many people know what fringe is? Okay. Fringe is basically how much you pay for benefits. So health insurance, medical insurance, life insurance, any of those benefits that your organization offers you, that's considered fringe. Whatever the cost, basically, of keeping you employed is. And some people or some organizations include things like the lights, copy paper, toner, coffee, those kinds of things in the fringe. Other organizations put those in indirect costs, which we'll talk about in a minute, at the bottom. So it's really up to your organization how they consider those costs, but it needs to just be consistent across every proposal you put together. So if on everything you guys say, okay, our total fringe is 44%, then fine. It just needs to be 44% across the board. You just can't say, okay, well, for you it's 25%, for you it's 35%, and for you it's 45%. Because if you ever get audited, it's really bad. Then travel. If you for any of you that are interested in doing international development work, travel is a big, big portion of your budget. So I have always used, and I think it's a wise thing to use the State Department rates for, they call it MNIE, so basically lodging, incidentals, and expenses. So use the State Department rates for, say you know for sure you're going to be doing a program in Brazil, and you think that it's going to, you know you're going to make five trips over the next 3 years to Sao Paulo. You can go on Kayak or Expedia or any typical travel website. Take 10 samples of flight costs and average them out. So you give yourself a little wiggle room. So we say, okay, average of $2,000 per flight, going five times, put that in your flight. Use the State Department rates for MNIE. Average about how much you think it's going to cost. If you know taxis are super, super cheap in Sao Paulo, yes, how much you can put in there. what be as accurate as possible, because you don't want to underspend and you definitely do not want to overspend. So this is a little bit of a guessing game and how much you think you're going to spend. But put as accurate numbers as you possibly can in there. For contractual, let's say you can do great work here in the U.S., and of course you're brilliant, but it's best to hire a local contractor, somebody on the ground in Sao Paulo to implement your program. So you know it's going to cost you, how much do we put in here? Let's say you want to hire somebody on the ground and pay them $50,000 per year to liaise with local organizations, host some trainings, develop some program materials, and you know that's what it's going to cost. You'd actually probably include that person, if you know who it is, you'd probably include that person's bio in the full proposal. If you don't have a particular person cited on ahead of time, you might include a job description, so explaining fully what that person would do. For this proposal, we were giving out emergency response funds to protect people who had been threatened by violence in quite a few different countries. And so there was some money set aside to make sure that people could access those funds. And we had several different local organizations contracted to in lots of different regions, so Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, and the Middle East and North Africa. So those organizations could hand out $1,000 or $2,000 to give some immediate relief or protection. So we set aside that money to make sure that that was available. This is, again, kind of a nitpicky thing, but for those of you who are working on a U.S. government grant, if you subcontract or subgrant out anything over $25,000, the first $25,000, the overhead number applies. If it's over $25,000, anything over that amount, it's not. So that just needs to go into your calculation at the bottom about how much overhead you're charging. Overhead you're charging U.S. government.
Can you repeat that?
So the first, let's say, let me find an example here. So for subaward one, the total amount for subaward one is going to be over $25,000. So you can charge overhead, and actually let me double check on that because I might be switching it in my head. Let me get back to you on that. Sorry, I want to make sure that I'm saying that correctly. But the $25,000 mark is the line in which on one side or the other, you do or do not charge overhead. So like at the break, I'll double check on that. Sorry. Then over other direct costs, this is for printing materials. You know how much it's going to cost you to make long distance phone calls. If you're sending money overseas, you want to make sure, because there are wire transfer fees, so you want to make sure that those costs are covered and you're not paying an additional $50 every time you send money overseas, so that could add up very quickly. So those kinds of charges, if you're paying $100 a month for Skype, you want to make sure to include that, those kinds of costs in here. And then, as I mentioned, you want to make sure to include any cost share amounts in that information to show the total amount. Any questions on the budget?
How likely is to include in the salary section administrative or operation positions of the organization? Meaning, for example, here we have two high-level positions and one mid-level position, but the whole operational team of the organization, how do you usually cover that? Could you include it in USAID grants for government grants, or mostly would be on private company grants like Gulf or Hilton?
Any grant that includes that position. So for instance, this is somewhat of a small program that didn't require a lot of admin support. There would be one manager doing the majority of the work and working with the finance team and to make sure that that's covered, but if there was a program assistant that was going to be working on this program, whether it's 100% of his or her time or 50%, you would just include that position in there. And that's not, it's not, doesn't make your proposal any less valuable or accessible or, you know, less likely to be funded because you have a program assistant there. Everybody understands that you need admin support. So if you have admin support, if you need admin support for this kind of program, definitely include them. You don't want to not include them and then need them and not have a way to pay them. Because that would be absolutely disastrous for you, and that would mean that your program manager is probably going to be working the equivalent of three jobs. Any other questions? Okay. We're actually a little bit ahead of time. I have us scheduled for a break, but if you guys want to keep going, maybe after the next section we'll take a break. So once, let's say, congratulations, you've now won your proposal, you get $500,000 to do this amazing, amazing program, and now you actually have to start implementing. So program and personnel management, and I lump those two together because they often go really hand in hand. Sometimes you're working for a really small NGO and it's just you in a one-stop shop. Other times you might be working for a massive organization and you have people on your team here in the U.S. and people that you're managing overseas who are implementing, and there's a lot of different personalities and communication styles and language, time differences, there's a lot going on. So it can be quite challenging to implement a program well when you're also dealing with personnel issues. So I think one of the major keys to running a successful program is also really well done personnel management. Hiring the right people to do the job, the people that have the best possible skills to implement. You might like somebody a lot as a person. If they don't have the skills to implement, it's going to lead to a lot of frustration down the line because they can't do the job, and you're now doing the equivalent of three jobs because you hired somebody to do something and they can't do it or they don't want to do it. So hire somebody that's, or make sure that the person slotted in that position is actually capable of doing that job. Then when you're starting to actually put the program into place, and there's a really colorful sheet of paper that I included that looks like this. This is actually a Gantt chart that shows the end of a project. If you are working on a project that is towards the beginning, see this bottom section where there's lots of different colored lines? That's what this whole thing is going to look like. See these solid lines up, or bars up here at the top? Those are because those things have already been done. Everything down here in the green, red, and purple, that has yet to be done. And so when you're starting out on a project, this is a really great tool. Not everybody uses it, but it is a great tool to use to figure out, okay, you've got a three-year project. You need to accomplish X, Y, and Z tasks. So let's say you want to have, for example, in this example, you're going to have a focus group session, then you're going to do a training, they're going to come up with a project afterwards, and they're going to do some implementation trips along the way at the end. And then it's going to be a closeout phase, so you're going to write up your final reports, you're going to tell your donor how you spent the money, you're going to do some monitoring and evaluation, hopefully you've been doing it along the way, I'll talk about that in just a second. To make sure that all of your program goals and tasks are being accomplished the way you hope that they would. And then you're going to write up a final report saying, I spent every single penny you gave me, and the project was incredibly successful, or certain things didn't go the way we wanted them to, and this is why, and this is what we learned from it. So again, the sample that I'm showing you here, each one of these, kind of see how the months are shaded different colors. So July is kind of a gray line, and August is left blank, just so you can, when you're looking at the whole thing, it's easier to tell. Each one of those is actually four small boxes. So if you have, so look down at the bottom, your ongoing support and financial reporting, just one of those. So if you had all four colored in, that would mean you have a whole month to do it. If you have just one of those little boxes colored in, it means you've got to do it the fourth week of that month. So it gives you a really, really clear guideline of when things are due, how often, particularly for reporting purposes. And so under the under each phase and each line underneath, it goes into pretty great detail about what you need to do for each part of that program. And you can make it, you can customize something like this as in-depth or as broad as you want it to. For those of you who are really, really task list oriented, yours might be in exceptional detail and might be 4 pages long. Chelsea has the most amazing system of organization that I've ever seen in my entire life, so hers would probably be 4 pages. I have other people on my team that there might be like 3 pages on this list, and there might be some frustration later on down the line. So you really kind of need to figure out what works for you, how much level of detail you think you need to put in here so that you know what you need to do and when, particularly for a government contract or for a government project. When reporting and doing monitoring and evaluation, include every single thing that you need to give to them, because if you do not do it on time, it's bad. So this is just a really helpful tool. This is called a Gantt chart, and I'm totally blanking on what it actually stands for, but G-A-N-T-T. And it's a very, very common tool that the nonprofit community uses to implement programs. If you are at all OCD or like extreme organization, it's a fabulous tool. Or if you're just super, super busy and you need a quick visual guide to help you figure out what you need to do on any given day, great, great resource. And it's not, again, not rocket science to implement. It's just an Excel spreadsheet and some fancy colors. Helpful tool.
All right, then let's go on to the task list. And this was something that somebody on my team put together recently for we had a big youth summit, about 4 days long, in the spring. And we had 40 participants coming in for a 4-day training. And there were quite a few different pieces that went into planning of this. So she did a great job of, again, you could literally copy and paste what's on your Gantt chart, and maybe this is a more detailed, so the Gantt chart you can either use for an overall program, what it's going to look like for a year or a 3-year program. This is more for, I guess, this is a great thing for a specific event. So let's say for your focus group, you know every single one of those things that needs to be done. You might need to break it down even a bit more, because let's say you've got some people on your team that are working on this, but you might need to pull in an admin person from, you know, that might not be working on this all the time, but might have a couple of hours to help you out. So you want to make sure that they know very clearly what it is that they're doing, when it's due, who they need to ask for help, and, you know, if there's any other additional information that they need to know. So this was put together to help our whole team, staff, interns, and me particularly, understand what was going on and sort of the big picture of all the different pieces of the pie and when they needed to be done. And it was a very, very helpful thing, because we could check things off as we got them accomplished to say, okay, this is done, or maybe we need to add a few more things onto this list because we all of a sudden, the venue where we're going to have the training had a fire, they've lost all their conference space, and they can't host us, so now we need to find a new venue last minute, so we need to start some of that process all over again. You know, things happen at the last minute, it's not uncommon, and you do need to be a bit flexible, but having something that keeps you organized and on track is a really useful way to make sure that you're getting everything done. Now, sometimes, and I will tell you, this happens not necessarily frequently, but there are times when you're running around like your hair's on fire. And that, just, especially when you're doing things overseas, happens a lot. because people don't necessarily work the way you do, or there might be a language barrier and a misunderstanding of where you thought you were going to put 50 additional participants, and they don't have the room set aside for you, so you need to find a hotel very quickly to host, you know, half of the people coming into your training. There's a government crack down on NGOs. They don't like people flying in from all over the region from other NGOs, and they might not let people come in from the countries that you are expecting them to. Things like that happen, so just be aware. Have some backup plans. It's helpful. Try to anticipate some of the issues that can come up, and that also comes with experience, knowing, you know, if it's
during the middle of the Arab Spring, you know, maybe your Egyptian participants are going to get a bit more scrutiny. Or, for whatever reason, Moroccan women get a lot more scrutiny when coming to other countries in the Middle East and North Africa, because there's a huge stigma about prostitution by Moroccan women, and so they'll ask for additional information when getting visas. So again, that's partially experience, just knowing, you know, you might need to allow some extra time and, you know, have a native Arabic speaker, you know, helping out with the visa process to make sure that you've got the right information that you need, and that you can get the type of tasks done that you want to, and by the deadline that you anticipated. Because the last thing you want to do is not anticipate that, you know, your Moroccan attendees are going to have a big problem, and then they're all stuck at the airport and they get shipped back home. That kind of destroys the whole point of your training. Any questions on the task list? And again, this makes it kind of seem like somebody is really, really OCD, but honestly, it's just a very, very helpful way, especially when you're really busy. And maybe you're working on three programs. You know, you've got 20% of your time dedicated to one program or one grant, 40% of your time dedicated to another, and 20% of your time dedicated to another. This is a great way to just say, okay, what do I need to get done, and be able to shift gears very quickly to be able to figure out what you need to do on any given day. Any other questions? Yeah.
I had a question on the last section, I forgot to ask it. Yeah. On salaries, how do you get the actual figures? Do you base it on the other organizations?
Well, your salaries, I mean, whoever's working for your organization should have a salary. So you're just going to use the actual numbers. Because we didn't want to show exactly how much each person made, we aggregated. And so our VP of finance actually gave us the aggregated number here.
Okay, I guess I mean for new projects, new organizations that are still actually setting up those.
So let's say you're hiring a new staff, you want to know how much to pay them. There's quite a few resources out there. I think Inside NGO actually has a list on their website of standard salary categories. That's also something Google. I mean, you can kind of tell, and each city is going to be different. So what people are making here in DC is probably a lot more than what somebody is making in Colorado Springs, because the cost of living here, apparently Washington DC just made it as the number one most expensive place in the entire country to live. Fantastic. So what people are going to be paid more here, because it's so much more expensive to live here. You can also check a kind of good baseline too, is the government system. So look at what a GS-9 makes, or look at what a GS-13 makes, and you can see what those salary levels are. That's often a good way to kind of gauge what a range is. I've Googled various, you know, just put in program officer, you know, nonprofit program officer salary range. Sometimes you can get good information that way. And of course, if anybody's willing to share with you at other organizations how much they're making or what the range is, that's a good way to kind of get a good idea.
And would your donors ask you to justify it somehow if they want proof of like, where you're getting this figure?
Yeah.
Can you say that at Google then?
No. No, I mean, the value is often set by you. You know, if you say, I'm an attorney, I have a law degree, I'm now taking, like, because we all kind of know, like, or at least maybe this is when I graduated from law school, and then, of course, the economy tanked, but, like, we kind of knew first-year starting salaries for an associate at a law firm, like, the average is, like, $120,000. It's kind of an industry standard. So you're also going to know, okay, so maybe, you know, in Colorado Springs, for a program manager, the average salary, give or take, is going to be $50,000. In Washington, D.C., maybe that level will be 60 or 75. Whatever it is, people aren't going to quibble over, you know, $10,000. It's more of like you say, oh, I've got $150,000 in travel costs. What are you doing? You know, that might be a little bit of more concern. But especially if you aggregate, they're not going to. And then that, if an organization or a donor is actually really concerned about how much somebody's making, let's say that number instead of 88,000 was 200,000. They might come back and say,
can you show us exactly what the summary breakdown is? But that's going to be probably more of a conversation with your head of your finance department, as opposed to you, the grant writer, putting this information. Because you probably are not going to have access to that kind of salary detail unless you're the VP, you're the director of the department, and you know exactly how much each salary is. And as long as you can show, okay, this is how much this person makes, this is their offer letter, here's a statement from our finance department saying this is how much they make, this is their educational background, this is their years of experience. Maybe it is totally legitimate for your vice president to be making $200,000 because they are Justice Goldstone. It might be completely legitimate because they have the most amazing experience on the planet, and you are really, really, really lucky to get an absolute rock star working for your organization, and you should be paying them accordingly. If you've got somebody with a bachelor's degree and 1 year of experience and you're paying them $200,000, then a donor is going to be like, probably not appropriate, and there might be some fraud issues going on there too. So I would say use your judgment, but industry standards are not uncommonly known, usually accessible by Google. And I would say talk to your peers too. A lot of times you can get really great. If you're starting something new, if you're writing a proposal for an established organization, they're going to have either a salary scale or documented information about salaries that they can pull together for you, particularly when hiring new staff. Or you can say, if we were to win this proposal, we would need to hire a new program manager. We plan on paying them $65,000. Not astronomical, seems fairly reasonable, and you would estimate that amount of money. Now, let's say when it comes time to hiring that person, and let's say you've got a rock star, but you really need to pay them $70,000 because they've got great experience, then that would be a conversation. It depends on how much that flexibility is. If you've got a total rock star and now you want to pay them $95,000, that would shift your salary quite a bit. So that would be a conversation that you'd need to either go back to your donor and say, okay, well, this is how they might not, let's say you're stuck at $500,000 total. You're not going to be able to shift that around. But you could go back to your donor and say, especially for the U.S. government, they require permission, at least this was 2 years ago, they require permission to change any of these line items by more than 10%. And you have to explain it. If it's $5,000 out of a $500,000 total, no bother. You can move some of that money around a little bit. You can save on some flights here. You can do a less expensive lunch there. That's not a big deal. It's when you're having some major salary differences or flight differences. If you anticipate taking 12 trips and all of a sudden you want to take 40, it's going to be a big difference. So you're going to need to talk to your donor about that.
If you're about to start a project and you don't have the person already, but you haven't been approved the grant yet, is it okay to start posting the job descriptions on the websites or on the current website without having the grant granted? I don't know.
A lot of organizations do that.
Right.
But
fine.
But in the job description, it says this position is conditional upon.
It has to have that clarification.
And a lot of, government subcontractors, Chemonix, Nathan and Associates, when they're bidding, they actually do contracts rather than grants, but when they're looking for staff to try to win a bid, they might do some recruiting and say, okay, great, we might even give you a provisional job offer, but it is contingent upon winning this bid.
Do you mind if we silence the phone?
Yes, I'm sorry. I forgot to go silence, but I don't know what's happening.
Just so the folks on it.
Maybe we can all check that. Just for a second to make sure. Okay. I actually would like to have a follow-up question in regards to the salaries, because I know we have some international students and corporate fellows who might be interested in applying for a grant. States, would you recommend, and I was also guessing, but
please clarify. Probably during the grant proposal, you will have actually to provide additional information. Are you actually basing the salaries on the local information, right? For example, government in a particular country. And that will be probably the same if you're hiring a contractor from the country as well, right? Necessary information will need to be provided during the grant proposal.
Yeah. So if you're especially if you're hiring local staff, again, if you, let's say you're working in Rwanda and you want to pay a local contractor $200,000 to implement a program there, but in Brazil you're going to pay somebody $25,000 to do the same kind of thing. If a donor is looking at those numbers and saying, why is there such a huge disparity, maybe it actually really costs $200,000 because there are so few people that are qualified to do the kind of work in Rwanda that you want, and you have to pay $200,000. And you can show a sample CV or something showing this person is really, really amazing and can do an absolutely phenomenal job, has worked for the UN for 15,000 years, and they can do this job where no one else can. But in Brazil, there's a flood of people who are doing this, and the going rate for this kind of work is $25,000. That might be something that you would need to show and explain. Hopefully, in the kind of local contractors and local implementers would be somewhat in the same range, depending on where you're working, because again, costs in Europe going to be much, much, much higher than if you were implementing in sub-Saharan Africa. So be honest, be as accurate as you possibly can, and when in your proposal process, a lot of times you will provide a detailed budget narrative to go, so see these lines, item numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all the way down to 40. A lot of times you will provide a budget narrative that explains every single one of these. So under your vice president, you're going to say, this person has, you know, 20 years of experience. They're only going to be dedicating 15% of their time to provide oversight and strategic guidance on this project. So this is how much it's going to cost. Or for salaries. And again, we're aggregating salaries on this one. But sometimes you might disaggregate that information and explain exactly how much it's going to cost. You know, say subaward one, you're going to spend $25,000 because labor is really inexpensive in... And I'm totally making this up, so don't judge me on the webcast if I'm picking random countries. But let's say it's really, really inexpensive to implement a project in Mauritania, but it's really, really expensive to implement a project in Uganda. So there's going to be some numbers, you know, between your subcontract to, or some differences in the numbers from your subaward to Mauritania and then to Uganda. And so then in the budget narrative, when you explain why that number is different, that's the opportunity to show a little bit more detail about what's going on there. Do you have another question?
Yes, I have another question. How do you see a lawyer's role in the, this type of organization, for example, and what will be the job name position of this job?
Very good question. And honestly, lawyers have a really unique place, I think, particularly in human rights organizations where everything that you're doing is based on the legal framework. So you can serve as a technical advisor and say, okay, I know where you can find all of these documents and resources, and I know what the law is that applies here, and this is how we should frame the entire work that we're doing around these legal principles. If you have the technical skills to be able to manage that program as well, you're going to be a much more hireable candidate because you've got the legal background and skills, and you know, you understand why things need to be done in a particular way in order to be, you know, to adhere to rule of law issues or to be the most effective, as opposed to just kind of fluffy surface level. Oh, we really think it's a great idea to build some wells. Well, if you don't explain, well, the right to water is a major economic and social right that is guaranteed in the ICESCR, and explain sort of that need piece, and be able to explain it to the people you're working with, maybe nobody will care. You know, this might be like, oh, well, yeah, clean water's nice. That's a great thing to have if you can.
So I think it's a great, your legal background is obviously a fantastic skill set, but these are the types of tools that you really do need to have in order to sell yourself in a non-legal environment, per se. So having a law degree is sort of like an extra sort of ace in the hole or card in your pocket to say, I'm really, really qualified. I can do all this. I can manage a budget like nobody's business. But I also understand the much deeper framework issues, the structural inequalities and legal frameworks that can address these issues and why it's so important. Does that help?
Yes, that helps. A job position would be, for example, a program officer. And yeah. A lawyer would be able to fulfill, to work in that role as a program officer, but would probably won't have a title, a job position as contract analyst, right? Because you're still, as a lawyer within this type of organization, you get to analyze sub-agreements, you get to analyze amendments and some legal documents. But I don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you get a job position as contract analyst, legal analyst. It's going to be something like program officer most likely, right?
Correct. Unless you're working in a contract office specifically. If you are working in a program implementation role, your job title would be more like program manager, program officer. Now, some of the really big organizations like Chemonix or some other big government subcontractors, they have a whole department that just works on contracts. But that's also something that kind of any lawyer can do. These kinds of skills are things that you really have to kind of go out of your way to develop these skill sets. And it's more for people who kind of want to get their hands dirty, go out into the field, work on human rights issues with the beneficiary populations, as opposed to somebody that just wants to do contract review. And it doesn't matter if you're doing contract review for, you know, World Vision or Save the Children, or if you're doing it for your average pharmaceutical company based here in Bethesda. I mean, it could be anything, right? You could be doing contract review for anyone. So these kinds of skills are specifically designed for, you know, the ones we're talking about today are designed for people who actually want to do more implementation. Does that answer your question?
Right.
Yeah, but your title would be more program officer, program manager.
Once you get the grant and you implement the program like in the development function, do you have like a solution to help the program sustain itself? Because most of the time you get the grant for 3 years or for a certain amount of time, and then you have nothing to continue.
That is a far deeper question that unfortunately we don't have time to go into today. The organizational development piece is something that a lot of organizations do to try to help local organizations be sustainable. But that's a very unique skill set, again, that you can develop, and there are some really great organizations. Inside NGO has a like 3-day training on organizational development to help you develop those skills. But that's a very, very specific skill set. And many organizations really, really focus on providing organizational development skills in addition to working with them to implement a program. Sure. Any other questions? Okay. So again, this is very high level, so apologies if I'm not going into great detail about how to implement a program. There's so many facets to this, and unfortunately we don't have time today to go into every single one of them, but I just wanted to give you sort of a high-level overview of what some of the common tools that you can use to either get your foot in the door or be successful, or say when you're looking for either an internship or a summer job, these are the kinds of skills that I want to learn to be able to get this kind of a job when I graduate. Another thing that I didn't put on here, but is something that's very, very a great tool to learn or a skill to learn, is either sub-grant management or grant management. Let's say you've got your organization has a pot of money and you want to, you know, it's based here in the US, but you want to get it out to local organizations in Zimbabwe. Well, you need to be able to analyze, is the proposal that they've given you something that you think that they can implement well? Is their budget appropriate? Are they asking for $50,000 and you think that they could really do this project for about five? You know, helping organizations explain to you why it costs them $50,000. So it's kind of this process, but in reverse. And there are a lot of human rights organizations based here in DC or in other parts of the country that do sub-grant management. And that is something that, as a law student, I found that I was able to ask to be included in that process and to get that skill set, because they knew, okay, she's got the technical skills, she's a law student, she has good analyzing skills. We can include her as part of that process, and maybe she'll have some different perspectives or different questions that we might not have thought of. And that's an opportunity that you can ask for when you're looking for job opportunities. And then for the final report, let's see. The document is the Stanton Foundation on here. And again, this is sort of the reverse of your project proposal. You're going to want to include the same information that you included in your proposal and say, okay, we told you we were going to do these five things with $100,000, and we did them, and they were successful in the following ways, or we encountered some significant challenges, and hopefully you will have told your donor about those challenges along the way. Do not surprise them in your final report. It's a really bad idea. Communication with your donor is really, really important, especially in this process. But you're going to want to explain what you did for that past year or those 3 years. What were your major successes? What were the lessons that you learned? Explain kind of in a high-level detail. This includes some success stories. It does include some project impact. But at this point, this was before I arrived at the Red Cross, it didn't delve too deeply into monitoring and evaluation, something that we've implemented over the past year, and I'm going to go over with you in a minute. But you're going to want to explain what your goals were for the project, how you met them, if you didn't achieve them, and why. Maybe you exceeded some, and explain why. Definitely toot your own horn, brag about the things you did really, really, really well, and explain thoroughly the areas that you didn't, or where there were some challenges, and how you addressed them. Because donors aren't unwilling to hear that you had some problems. I mean, shoot, if you're trying to implement a program in Egypt during the middle of the Arab Spring, donors are going to know, okay, there's going to be some significant challenges there. Maybe every NGO in Egypt is getting kicked out right now, or thrown in jail. You know, maybe your local implementer has been arrested because they do not like NDI right now, and they are putting everybody that's affiliated with them in prison until the U.S. Embassy, you know, throws a fit and kicks them out. So there might be some significant challenges that you faced, but explain why. They're not unwilling to hear what happened, and say what your workaround was. The project that I worked on in Egypt, the original proposal that we submitted, and this was a State Department grant, you know, we put a proposal together, sent it over to MEPI, and that was plan A. We went through plans B, C, D, E, F. I think that's like M. I mean, we stopped counting after a certain point because the government was changing every 5 minutes. People were getting thrown in jail every 5 minutes. People were on lockdown. You never knew what was going to happen. So being flexible, hopefully your donor is flexible and understands some of the shifting, especially if it's a politically based project. They understand that shifting political territory. So they're willing to work with you, but just be honest with them. Tell them what's going on, because they can't be flexible if they think you're either lying to them or hiding things, or you're not being completely transparent about the challenges, or let's say, worst case scenario, you've got a sub-grantee somewhere that has stolen money. Tell them. You can't address it unless you tell them. And say how you're going to prevent that from happening in the future. Maybe you need stronger organizational development to say, we need to ask far more questions about what their systems and processes for managing finances are in the beginning. And we didn't ask enough. That would have shown us a checks and balances to make sure that the president of this organization isn't the only one with financial access to this pot of money, and that there's a finance director and that there's implementers who are tracking that money. So you want to be very, very clear about what's going on. And if the problems arise, you tell them about it. Don't just tell them in your final report, because that's not a very nice surprise to give them. And we're going to get into a little bit more of the budget management and monitoring and evaluation skills later, but I did want to give you guys an opportunity to ask any questions about the final report as well. And I know that this is kind of a lot to read, and I'm just swinging it on you at the last minute. I'm going to give you guys a break here in a minute, but if you want to read over it and ask some questions, or if you want to read over this tonight, any of these materials tonight too, you can come back and ask me more, because I will be here. So it's about 2:15 to 20 right now. Let's come back at 2:30, and we can wrap up the last one.
They'll edit it out.
We will actually take care of that with the other guys. We will have something to eat, refraction, so we can continue.
I wish this might actually expand into a more.
This is my first crack at it.
What does everyone else do? Those who then go into that traditional double CL. Like as far as going into that, just how
a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of what I do. I work for Millennium Water Alliance, water communication, and I am kind of related. Like I draft agreements, but it's also administrative, and so I am in that limbo, and I'm trying to figure out what's my next step.
How long have you been here?
4 years now, okay. Almost. So it was perfect. It's not that I'm leaving. My boss is amazing, but it has been perfect because it has allowed me to study and work. But I'm getting to a point, I already finished my LLM program, and I have a master's, and I have my law degree from my country. So I am thinking about, I need a change. Right now I haven't decided because I'm thinking about the law in New York. But I'm wondering, what's my next step? Like, if these people, what should I ask for in here? That's why I was asking you about the role.
Yeah, I would say it depends. I don't know what opportunity or the types of jobs that are in your organization. But I would say look at the job opportunities in all the different departments or teams. See if there are things that you think would fit your skill set or even a skill set you want to develop. Things that you could contribute already, and when you either in a personal conversation with your boss or if you have your annual review or a mid-year review, say, look, I've got three law degrees now, or you know, a master's, a law degree, and an LLM. I'm learning all of this really great information. I think I can contribute more than what I'm doing now. I know that there are certain skills that I probably need to develop, but I really want to work on developing those so that I can get to the next level. When I've had staff come to me and say, I know I'm doing this right now and I love what I'm doing, but I want to develop my skills so that I can further contribute to this organization, I'm like, fantastic. I want you to be able to grow. I want you to be able to do different things because I don't like staff turnover. No boss likes staff turnover. So if you can say, I want
No boss like what?
Like staff turnover, like staff leaving and then having to hire new staff. If you've been there for 4 years, you have a lot of institutional knowledge, and if you say, I want to be able to move up the ladder and take on new responsibilities and to use the new skills that I'm learning in my law degree program to contribute to the organization. If it's a good organization, it's a good supervisor, they're going to jump all over that and say, we want to help you get to that point. Or maybe there's no opportunities now, but you say, okay, great, but I want to maybe do some job shadowing or figure out what sort of skills I need in the future to learn those
things. Sounds great. One more question. MWA, we're very, 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 very small nonprofit, but it's composed of 30 huge members. The biggest one is Water and Sanitation Product, including Water for People, Care, World Vision, WaterAid, all of those. Would it be weird if I look into all these 30 being in the umbrella of all of them?
Not at all. I think it's a great idea. It's a very, very good skill. Because there might be some especially it's really hard when you're working for a really small organization to branch out. But if you've got relationships with people at any of those umbrella, you know, the spokes on those umbrella
organizations? I don't. And that's the
thing
that
my boss... But
your boss
might be able to help you develop some relationships.
You think that's like probably... That's the thing that I don't feel that I can make the crossover because I don't have that advocacy with the other organization directly. I manage the whole thing and like the grants with them and I create like follow up on the things. But I don't have the network with them.
When you're managing grants, do you have a point of contact at CARE?
No, because I do it through my boss. And that's
I would talk to your boss. Say you, in order to manage your grant really well, you'd like to get a better understanding of what these sub-grantees are doing.
That should work, right?
So, even going and having a coffee with the person who's managing the grant, just to get a better understanding of how they're doing their job.
Okay.
It might give you a lot of information.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Very helpful.
I have a little bit related question. I'm working at the partnership at the World Bank, Global Partnership for Education. Now I'm start working in advocacy. But we already have all these traditional donors. We have we have BFID, we have the European Commission. Like the traditional people is already more. And they are already they are partners, donors. We are focusing primarily in Africa. We have some Latin American countries. But what I am proposing then is try to go to Latin America and to do some shopping there, because you never know. But when you're doing this kind of advocacy, how do you start it? Because I need to give an offer to them, a proposal, and say, okay, let's start doing this. Let's
Google. Find out if there are any big, heck, maybe Carlos Slim has a real passion about making sure that people in really, really remote rural areas have access to communications. And maybe he's got a foundation as part of his global telecoms empire. Gives him money. He has a really dedicated corporate social responsibility arm that gives money to those.
Here we go.
Oh, thank you so much. Research, you know, what are the big companies in that that specific area? You know, it's water and sanitation, communications, or education, or whatever. Find out what organizations care about those issues. See if they have any local presence or foundations that work there. There's a ton of them out there. And, you know, maybe even see, say, Open Society here. Ask them, do you guys have a branch in Latin America? Or do you have any partners in Latin America that are specific to this? A lot of them will know, particularly the big ones that do a lot of work overseas. So, yeah, OSI, the Ford Foundation, a lot of those work. Yeah, ask who their local partners are.
Thank you.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. I'm just doing private donations right now. And kind of just want to continue to like a separate thought is money from the grants, but I'm just wondering about supporting the permits if they're more stringent. And some, I mean, because right now there's very little reporting requirements.
It depends on the size of the grant you're going after. And if you're going after a $500,000 project and it needs to be implemented in 1 year, you're going to need more staff than that just to implement it.
Right.
You know, if you're going after a $50,000 grant, and you know it's from a local foundation, their reporting requirements might be that 4-page.
So it's actually up to the organization that's doing the grant, right? Yeah. Versus the government, I think, is going to have more stress. That's what I'm trying to. If I want to even venture into that,
for grant, you know, there's the contracting side for government and there's the granting side. I would say for the granting side, you do need more staff. Mm-hmm. If it's just a one-stop shop, it's a lot of work to do the reporting, the proposal for all that.
We're kind of stuff. We just do this stuff and we've gotten right more.
Yeah, that might be something that you want to work up too, but for now, start with the foundations, the smaller grants, and then as you build your staff, paid staff that has the time and skills to do it, you will get to the capacity level where you could implement.
It just sounds like it's too much work.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay, well hopefully the room will cool off a little bit. I don't know about you, I'm just super warm.
This is actually my favorite part. I did not think that it would be. So, a little bit of background. My first day of law school, my courts class, my professor told us, congratulations, you are in law school, you will never have to do math again. And that was the biggest lie I have ever been told. And so if you had handed me this spreadsheet in 2000, whatever, when I started law school, I would have died. I would have looked at this and said, oh my God, I will never, ever be able to do this. This is the most confusing thing I've ever seen. There are lots of numbers, very few words. Can't do it. If any of you have heard me talk about my job recently, you have probably heard me mention multiple times over that my job now sounds really great, you know, Director of International Humanitarian Law at the Red Cross. That sounds very fancy. What I really am is a budget monkey. And this is what I look at all day long, every day. Sometimes I do other things, but the vast majority of the time, I'm sitting in front of this. But, little known secret, whoever controls the budget controls the power. So, you control the money, you get to decide what to do with it. Now, granted, you're still responsible to your donor, you still have to do what you say if you're going to do, but you do have a little bit of flexibility on how you approach those things. And is, I'm just wondering, background noise, is that too much? Okay. Okay. So, again, sorry for anyone who's listening online. The room is about 90,000 degrees as we open some windows, so there's a bit of background noise, so we're going to shut them. We'll be in a different room tomorrow, so hopefully it won't be as hot. Okay, so I mentioned earlier that this is a much more detailed budget than the program budget, right? I mean, it's got a lot more line items. It's got quite a bit more information about where this money is going, how it's going to be spent, and the timeline. Again, this is actually at the end of a project, so this is after quite a bit of this money has already been spent. It was originally designed as a one-year project, but because of some political turmoil, it took a lot longer to implement, finding participants who were willing to actually participate because it was somewhat of a, there were some safety concerns. So it took 6 months longer to have an original training than we thought it would. So this was a USAID grant, and so we asked, so you'll see up at the top, where it says the 2 month NCE and 3 month closeout, NCE is a no cost extension. So we said, okay, let's say everyone would be like $463,000. We're still going to spend $463,000, but we're just going to take 18 months to implement this program instead of 16, or is it a 12? So you're not going to actually give us any more money. We're just going to take a little bit longer. And so we applied for that extension. So you'll see the actuals. So we started this program in summer of 2009. So we didn't spend a lot of money. It was basically just kind of stack time, trying to figure out what we're going to do, how we're going to implement it in 2010. 2011 was when we started spending some money. We had a staff travel. There were some flights. We had consultant travel. Under participant travel, you'll see that there were quite a bit of flights and lodging, quite a bit of money spent for flights and lodging. So we had a workshop. So all that money was spent for a participant workshop. And so you'll see down in trainings, conferences, and summits, all that money went towards the conference costs for that, that we calculated separately from the flights and lodging. So then we have, let's see, so that was in 2011. This was prepared during the summer of 2012. So we, our finance team, the way that they calculated money, they had completely up-to-date numbers of what we had spent up through May of 2012, so we calculated all of that money. Then this was actually submitted in June of 2012, so we had some really good ideas of where that money was going to be spent that month. And then the 2 month NCE or no cost extension plus the 3 month closeout, again, doing a report, making sure that we had all of our budget items submitted, that was what we anticipated those costs were going to be. And you'll see at the very, very, very bottom, in the very last box in the corner, $0. Means we plan on spending every single penny of this project. But as we went along, we noticed that money was going to be spent a little bit differently than what we had anticipated 3 years early, actually it's more like 5 years earlier when the proposal was actually submitted compared to where we actually spent it. So, and again, that's fine, just communicate with your donor. So we applied for a budget modification. We decided instead of spending, I'll give you a made-up example, instead of spending $100,000 on a consultant to do implementation locally, consultant didn't turn out quite as great as we thought, so we were going to actually implement, and we're going to put $50,000 of that. We, you know, we paid $50,000 for our consultant for the first year and a half. It wasn't that great. So we're going to spend that extra $50,000 and have an additional training and do some sub-granting to the participants to do some global implementation projects. So we had to explain to USAID, this is what's happened, here's how we want to reallocate that money, and here's how we're going to spend it. So this is a budget that was prepared actually to say to USAID, we want to modify the budget. This is how we're going to spend it, and this is when we're going to spend it. And they came back and said, okay, great. But it was not just the budget modification process is a bit long and far too in-depth for this conversation today. But just so you have an idea, when you're tracking your budget, this is a great thing to have to see where things are being spent, where the actuals that you're spending are coming in versus what you thought you were going to spend. And then if you need to make any modifications, capturing that information in there, and you see the difference column, you can either do that in real numbers or you can do it as a percentage. And again, check the rules, because maybe in your grant agreement, you've decided anything under 10% difference is totally okay. You don't need to even tell them about it. You're just going to do it. If it's over 10%, you need to either ask permission or notify them. Again, it totally differs on each contract or grant, but you just need to follow the rules that you've been assigned. And again, a lot of people don't know, even with the U.S. government, those grants are negotiable. You know, they offer you, you know, some money, and they give you everything in the kitchen sink in there as far as rules are concerned. Some of those are negotiable, some of them are not. But if you think you can do, you know, things a bit differently or more efficiently, or you say, well, it's going to actually take us a little bit more time to do this, talk to them about it. They're willing to negotiate on the contracts. Any questions on budget? And by the way, you're going to... this is a great thing to update pretty regularly. Again, just to know where you're spending your money. The next document that we're going to look at is a bit more high level to help you track monthly what this is looking at. This is more of a detailed budget, especially when you're showing a donor where that money, like why there's such a big difference if you need to move some money around. Any questions? All right, let's move on then to the burn rate management. The first time I heard this, I thought, that's the stupidest term for any sort of budget monitoring tool I ever heard. But it basically just means how fast are you blowing through your money. And you're hopefully going to be on track. So this is, again, this was prepared at the end of a project. So this was in, let's see, January of 2013. So this is at the very end of the closeout period. I think the final report was due January 31st or something. So I had spent the vast majority of this money. So this gives you, again, remember in 2010 we didn't spend very much money. The grant came in the summertime, so it was just staff time and trying to figure out how you're going to implement this program. During 2011 there was a participant workshop, there was some travel, so there about half of the budget actually was spent in 2011. It was supposed to be done by 2011, but because of some political complications, we said, okay, well, we're going to ask for an extension, and we're going to go into 2012, because we need about 6 or 8 months more to implement this program. So about a third of the budget was then, or actually more like half, was then spent in 2012. So it shows sort of a yearly summary, and again, you can update this as often as you want. I found it helpful to update it monthly because you get a report, which I'm going to show you in a minute, from your finance team saying how much money you've spent under which categories, and you can update those numbers. So if on one of these categories, you know, you've got a 60% burn rate, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, if that's your travel line item, and you've got $200,000 in there, and you've only spent 60% of it, and you've got 3 months left in your project, you know, you either need to spend a heck of a lot of money, or something's gone really wrong, and you need to figure out how to fix it fast. If you are spending way more, okay, so see the last one under other direct costs? I spent 129% of that budget, but the actual costs are really, really low. So I only overspent that budget line by $1,100 or $1,200. So in the grand scheme of things, that's not such a big deal. Now, because my agreement with USAID was that if any line item was, there was more than a, either 10 or 20, I can't remember now, if it was more than a 10 or 20% difference, I'd explain it. So, okay, fine. I said we had more Skype calls and we paid more for shipping than we had anticipated because, again, remember we fired that consultant, so we did a lot more here in the U.S. than having her do it, and those costs are just categorized a bit differently. So again, they're not going to quibble with me over $1,000. They don't care. They just want to know why. And so this is a really great way to just make sure you're on track. And depending on what your organization's comfortability level is, it's definitely a good idea to, you know, if you could spend down to the penny, great. If you, you know, if your organization is comfortable with within 5%, because you might actually have to give that money back. So say you have $463,000, $463,225.46. If you spend $459,000, you might actually have to give that $4,000 back. And that's okay, and your finance department can write a big fat check and, you know, pop it in the mail. USAID would gladly take your $4,000 back. And you're not gonna, they're not gonna ding you for not spending that $4,000. If you've underspent by $100,000, that might show up in your performance review. Because it, you know, again, if you're not spending $100,000, remember that the indirect costs? So here it's 21%. If you don't spend $100,000, the organization does not get to collect 21% of that to cover the lights, the general admin for the organization, your finance person's salary, maybe your president's salary, things like that. That money is what keeps the lights and the doors open. So you want to spend as much, as close to the penny on this as possible. Now, sometimes you get $4,000 back, and that's okay. You know, some organizations want you to spend within 15% of your budget, and that's because they're a bit more flexible on that, and that's okay. Figure out what your organization comfortability level is. Again, if you can spend another penny, great. I think anything, this is just my personal comfortability level, I don't like to go over 5. And certainly not 5 over. Very rarely. I mean, if you spend $200 over, fine. Please don't spend over. It makes donors very unhappy, and then sometimes you have to take it out of general operating costs, and that also cuts into the executive director's salary, and she doesn't like that. Or he doesn't like that. So, please don't overspend. If you underspend, please keep it within 5%, just because it makes everybody happy. And if there's a huge difference or a significant difference, either ask permission or notify your donor, depending on what the rules are, that you agree upon in advance. Any questions? Again, you don't have to do this. This is just a tool for you to be able to track your money, because God forbid that 3 months left of a multi-year project, you try to figure out how much money do I have left that I need to spend, and that, oh crap, I can't spend $100,000 in a month. Then you're going to have a big problem. I actually did last year, because I came in halfway through the year, and our reporting had changed quite a bit, and so I had to spend $200,000 in the last month of the fiscal year. One of the hardest things I have ever had to do, but I spent $200,000 in a month. Now, granted, some of that was because we had big events planned just in that last month of the program, but I was nervous, thinking, better spend this money and the numbers better come out right and our vendors better be invoicing us correctly and on time. I mean, we were trying to, like, give money away. We were trying to spend it on whatever we could that was within the guidelines of our program. But it's really hard to spend a lot of money at the last minute, so you don't want to be caught unaware at the last minute when you're trying to close out a program, particularly if the government is implementing it or if you're getting money from the government. So this is just a really, really helpful tool to make sure that you're spending money on time and for the things that you said that you would want to spend them on. Any questions? Your BVA, the budget versus actuals, otherwise known as a P&L or a profit and loss statement. Different organizations have different names for them. I've heard them called all sorts of things. Basically, this is just your monthly report from your finance team. They send you a list of everything you've spent, and because you've submitted a budget ahead of time to them and they have it in the system, they can track what you spent your money on and under what category. Now, sometimes you might need to move some things around because something got miscategorized, or say they, you know, charged 14 flights from the Latin America team and you were on the Africa team and you say, no, 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 not ours, we need to move that money back, charge it to the right program, keep an eye on this because they are very, very overworked and sometimes, you know, mistakes happen and, you know, you just want to make sure that all of the things that you were supposed to be spending money on actually get captured and that nobody else's expenses get put under yours. So this is the way that our organization does it. This is actually the very beginning of our fiscal year. So you'll see that this is from August. And so it doesn't have a lot in it so far. It's basically 2 months of salaries because we, you know, during the summertime, we're pretty light on programming. We don't have a lot of conferences because nobody's around, nobody's in D.C. We work with a lot of law schools and student groups across the country. They're all on summer vacations, so they don't do a lot in the first couple of months. But you'll see some of the commentary there. You know, we're doing pretty well on the compensation. We have a few minor travel expenditures, not a lot. But you'll see the last category. So, you know, month to date, how much did we think we were going to spend in the month of August, capturing that? Year to date, how, you know, we're 2 months into the fiscal year, how are we doing compared to how much we think we're going to spend in July and August versus the rest of the year? We know we're going to spend most of the money between September and May. So making sure that we capture that correctly. And then annual, out of all the whole pot of money, how are we doing? How much have we spent so far? And that percent variance is a really good way to see, you know, overall how we're doing. So you'll see for salaries, we're at 100.86%. That means we're doing spot on salaries. We knew how much we were going to spend on salaries down practically to the penny. I mean, we might have been like 4 pennies over, which is why the 0.8% is there. So they, you know, gave us kudos. Well done spending on salaries. You knew exactly how much your team makes, how much people are going to be charging to each program. It was pretty simple because we only had certain people charging to certain programs. We didn't have it divided up by, you know, some hours on this project, some hours on that one, and that makes compensation a bit more complicated. But to me, you know, these people getting paid this much, we're going to be charging to this budget. And so we can track that quite carefully. Any questions on this? And you'll have you'll probably have a finance person explaining this to you. And if you have any questions or, you know, some wonky things show up and, you know, all the Latin American flights get charged to your Africa program, you can tell them, hey, how much coffee did you not have today? Go back and fix it. But the vast majority of the time, this is a pretty great way to see is the finance team tracking, you know, is the finance team tracking what you've got captured in your burn rate, and you can use some of the detailed line items from the BDA to inform your burn rate. So you've got, everybody's got their ducks in a row. And if there's a significant difference between these two documents, then you've got a problem. And then you go back, and it's probably because, you know, $50,000 worth of Latin America flights got charged to your Africa budget, and you go, move that away. Does that make sense? Any questions?
This BVA is project oriented.
this is, the BVA is for project?
Yes. So, for example, there is, in this budget, there's $689,000 for this project. So, now some finance systems are able to break that down a bit more and say, well, we've got three projects within this overall program, and you can be a bit more categorical about where that money is going, but this is very high level. And this is, you know, so complete honesty here, this sheet is about one of 13 that I get per month from my finance team, but this is just a high level, like what you're looking at. That he also gives me a list of every single expenditure that's hit, what category it's gone under. You know, there's all sorts of really pretty charts and, you know, graphs and things that I can, you know, being the visual person that I am, that I can get a quick glance at how I'm doing. And because I have, this is only one of my pots of money. So, you know, I want to see, am I spending really, really well? You know, I'm at 100.86 on my compensation on this, but I'm at 50% on my other budget, and I might need to move some things over. Maybe I lost a staff person, and I need to hire, and that lag in the staff compensation, it means that I have a lot of money that I haven't allocated, or that is not being charged appropriately. So I need to hurry up and hire somebody really quickly. Or Uprising in Egypt couldn't implement a project or a training that I thought was going to happen in August, and I had to push it back to October. That's going to show up here. But you're going to understand why. And that's what the conversation with your finance person is going to be, to say, okay, we thought we were going to do this in August, now we're going to do it in October. And they just go, okay, great. So if you're at a 20% variance rate, that makes sense, because once you're in October, it's going to be caught up again. Any other questions? Okay. Actually, that was all I had for today. We were really, really booking today. So any other questions? I know that some of you had some questions at the break, and kind of more specifics on how do you think about the job field or applying for jobs. And we'll have some time tomorrow, too, especially once Eric's here, to talk about some of these things. But happy to answer your question.
How do fundraisers make? How do they open the business? This is the question I always have. People do it out of the goodness of their hearts, yes, but how do they do it?
It depends on the model. And there are some people who are professional grant writers, and they might get a specific percentage of whatever they bring in. So let's say they bring in a grant for $1 million to an organization. Well, they've already agreed with the organization beforehand that they get 2% of whatever they bring in. So they get that cut. It's a hard way to make money. I personally would not want to do it. I mean, I like fundraising, but I would not want to gamble my rent on being able to do it. But there are some people who do it and do it really, really well and that make a ton of money doing it. But it does depend on the organization. A lot of small NGOs, that's probably not the model that they can use. Sometimes they'll either have a volunteer or a board member or maybe a part-time staff person or a contractor that they've just hired for a short period of time and say, we'll hire you for 10 days. Just put this grant report together. We'll give you $2,000 to write the grant. So it really depends. A lot of the bigger MSI, Chemonix, they've actually got people on staff that do this, and this is part of their performance process or performance analysis. So, they have to raise a certain amount of money. The Red Cross, we have professional fundraisers. They are given targets and set goals of how much money they are expected to raise. And if they're not meeting those targets, then their performance is based on that target. They might not keep their job. Or as if they way, way over exceed, they might get a bonus or some other form of recognition for the work that they're doing. Any other questions? Okay, great. Well, tomorrow we're going to be talking, you can see on the agenda, we're going to talk about monitoring evaluation. I know some of you have had questions about that, so we'll definitely spend a little bit more time talking about log frames and evaluations.
advocacy, because I know, again, some of you are thinking about how to get into that field. And then Eric Guthrie will be joining us to talk about, because I obviously am very, very focused on the nonprofit sector, but government practice is also a big part of that, and so making the transition, and he'll talk more about his background, but he went into government practice at the beginning of his career, moved to the private sector, and then moved back. So he'll talk a little bit more about some of the tools and tricks and how to leverage the experience that you're getting if you're looking for those kinds of jobs. We're working on putting those online. So we're trying to figure out, so the podcast will be available online, and so we're trying to figure out which documents we can put online afterwards. And of course, you can keep the hard copies. And again, I fully believe in not reinventing the wheel. So, you know, use as much of this as possible. Some of it I came up with, some of it I've got colleagues that came up with this stuff, and they're brilliant. So, you know, this is not rocket science. Anybody that can pass the LSAT can do this. it's not incredibly difficult. It's just knowing that lingo so that when you're applying for a job somewhere, you can say, yeah, I know what the Gantt chart is, and sure, I can totally do it. You know, if you've got the tools and if you can Google, you're going to be in pretty good shape. But I wanted to make sure you knew what to look for, what to ask, and what skills you need to focus on in order to learn, in order to go after those kinds of jobs. All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for speaking.
And I'm